This is Melissa, and today is the 7th of July, 2024. I hope everyone is doing all right. I was around a lot of family for the last week. I had family in town, many of whom I had not seen in many years since before Canada. Probably 17 years for a couple of relatives, even longer, many, many years for a group of family that was here. And it was a range of people from probably 18 years old to 95. So it was an interesting opportunity to study human nature. Besides which, there was a lot of fun and good food, and it was a break in routine, and it was nice. One thing that I noticed was that a lot of there are probably five or six different relatives are teachers or academics, and their class levels range from, I think one of them teaches the third grade, and two of them are university professors. Actually, four of them are, if you count their wives. And there was a definite bias to the liberal or left, or in the UK they would say labor, woke, amongst the teachers and the academics. And I was trying to just have a conversation. I never want to preach or even reach out to people with things that I think or know unless it's very clear to me that they're seeking to understand something. And frankly, I've never really found that in my family. So I generally just am quiet and observant. I wouldn't say quiet. That's not possible. But I don't talk about things that are going to make people uncomfortable, because what's the point? So one relative who is a teacher started to talk about how she's using more gender-neutral pronouns now, since some of her students are non-binary. And another relative and I were a young teacher. We were having a nice conversation, and I was talking about some heavier things, but nothing that was challenging. I was talking about listening to your inner voice or your conscience, would be another way of putting it, and not doing things that go against that. And she said, yes, I've had some of these same thoughts myself, because as a teacher, we have to teach people the correct way to speak. And of course, that makes me feel bad because it brings up issues of privilege. Who has the privilege in a society? So you could see where that conversation was going. And I found out that one young relative, distant by marriage, is head of sustainability for a large bank, and it went on and on. And there were some conservatives in the family. And at one point, a small group of us went on a train ride and a state park. It was a bit of a drive to get there, and then we took the train ride through the piney forest, and it was pleasant. There was a lot of junky food to eat and laughs and songs about trains, and it was not an unpleasant outing. And we took a break. At one point the train stopped and we ate at the little park concession area, and you lined up and you got your food, and then you went to the picnic tables, and there was a gift shop inside that had drinks and water and so forth, and And so that was the stop was basically to allow you to get some refreshment and have a break, stretch your legs. And one of the conservative family members got to talking about what women should and shouldn't do. And the two younger, more woke family members that were there, I could tell they were just kind of looking at this. And one of them said, well, what do you mean women shouldn't do this? And, yeah, so the other person, who I know is provocative, said, well, I mean, it's really been this way since women got the vote. And he went on to say that the reason why women shouldn't be in certain positions in society is because women are not rules-based. They're relationship-based. And they'll break rules or ignore rules to protect a relationship, whereas men are going to acknowledge that rules are necessary for society to function, and even if they don't like the rule or the rule they perceive might be harmful to them or their family, they may still follow that rule because it's a rule. It's there. And I remember, Alan, I'm sure that you've all heard Alan say that men are naturally more conservative and that women will try new things first. And, of course, he brought up often the famous, you know, Hitler knew to bypass the man and go for the woman, and where the woman went, the children would follow, and then the man would have to follow as well. So that's how you change culture. So I heard this conversation. I could kind of gauge, it wasn't outright discomfort, but just, you know, these kind of surprised looks, I guess, of the younger women in the crowd. And I decided that it was time to go to the gift shop and get some refreshments. And when I got there, there was a young fellow that was like a guard / employee who was pulling the one of those chain link doors, you know, that he's going to lock up the gift shop. And I said, you're closing? And he said, yes, we're just open for, you know, long enough for people to come in, buy a t-shirt or a hat and bottled water or whatever. But I could see just on the other side of that chain door was a ice chest kind of thing where they were selling ice cream bars and ice cream snacks. And I wanted those for the group. So I just walked past him in the little opening of the chain door. And I said, oh, I'll just be a moment. I went in and got a bunch of ice cream and got in line. And I paid for the ice cream and I got some paper towels and I went out and I sat back down and the conversation was still going. And I passed out the ice cream and everybody was happy for it. And I said, yeah, they were closing down, and I just brushed right by them and ignored it, bought the ice cream. There was a pause. I could see a twinkle in one of the older fellow's eyes, and I said, well, I'm a woman. Rules don't apply to me, right? And he said, good. Good, yay. Yay you for ignoring the rules. But in listening to these two younger relatives talking, the teachers, one thing that came up in conversation with both of them, they were mother and daughter, both teachers, was that both of them talked with great fondness about community and the importance of community, the need for community. And they live pretty far away from the rest of the family. And one of them even said, you know, I'd always been kind of a favorite of hers because she didn't have a lot of family, et cetera, et cetera. So it was interesting the ways in which they had gone about creating community for themselves. And the younger one, the daughter, said, community is everything. the community has to look out for each other and take care of each other. And it got me to thinking about what is community? How do we define that? Where do people get that sense? Is it important? Is it more important to women than to men, for instance? And so when I was trying to choose a talk for today, there were several things that I was reminded of that had come up over the week. Last weekend on the book club installment that was live on Telegram, and then I did a video for and just posted that yesterday. There were several comments in that chat that struck me. The first, Nick, who led the discussion and set it up and did a really good job there, was talking about the Fabian way. And that is the slow and steady. And I learned something that I didn't know before from that chat, which was that before the wolf in sheep's clothing, or we see that stained glass of the anvil hammering the world into shape, the turtle was the logo for the Fabians. Both Andrea, who moderated the event or made sure that people's mics were muted and talked when they wanted to, and is Darren's wife, and Nick drew parallels between communism and communitarianism. And at another point in the talk, Darren mused what would happen after Ukraine, that basically what's going on there is an extension of the Cold War. We had NATO, right? After World War II, ostensibly to help protect Europe against communism. But Clinton strengthened NATO rather than disbanding it, as would have been the logical outcome after the end of the Cold War. And Darren was just musing, what will happen? He said, somebody has to be seen as the moral victor in this situation. So after thinking about everything that had been ticking through my head and the book club and so forth, I thought maybe I would just go and find a talk where Alan got into communitarianism. And as it turns out, there were several of those talks. And I think it's possible that there are several talks that Alan did where he went much deeper into the ideas of communitarianism than he did in this talk. But after I listened to this from February 23, 2007, I was so struck by the overall tone of the talk and many good things that he said in here. It was just And I was also struck that I hadn't listened to it probably since he originally delivered it, February 23, 2007. Ukrainian genocide, Ukrainian anti-Freemasonic bill is the title of it. It's just a really good talk that I am pleased to be bringing you. There was an article that Alan mentioned from a magazine called Moz News, which is no longer in existence, it would appear. I was able ultimately to find that someone had reproduced the article, so I'll post that up, where he's talking about how that someone had proposed that they pass a bill that Freemasons in the Ukraine be jailed. So this is 2007. But before I stumbled on the article, when I just typed in those keywords looking for it, I couldn't find it. And I kept going, I couldn't find it. But I was really interested at what did show up on the search. It was a very odd collection of articles, to say the least. And the thread that seemed to tie them together was that anti-Freemasonry hysteria is connected to anti-Jewish hysteria or anti-Semitism. I found, you know, three different articles that had that thread in there, including one that was railing against Mel Gibson, who had his famous drunken anti-Jewish rant right about that time. So that was kind of an interesting thing, but one of the articles that came up of those three was Christopher Hitchens. And Christopher Hitchens, this is from October 2007, had an article here called Defending the Term Islamofascism. And it may be the circles I don't run in or what I do and do not read, but that term, Islamofascist, is not one that comes up for me every day. I had done a real history with Sean Ross, and it came up then. And it certainly gave me pause in that conversation. But I'll link to this article. You can read it for yourself if you're interested. But when I'm just going to pick out a little bit there. He said in an article, he called it fascism with an Islamic face. He thought that there were obvious points of comparison, and he said both movements are based on a cult of murderous violence that exalts death and destruction and despises the life of the mind. Death to the intellect, long live death, as General Francisco Franco's sidekick Gonzalo Delano so pithily phrased it. Both are hostile to modernity, except when it comes to the pursuit of weapons, and both are bitterly nostalgic for past empires and past glories. Both are obsessed with real and imagined humiliations and thirsty for revenge. Both are chronically infected with the toxin of anti-Jewish paranoia, interestingly, also with its milder cousin, anti-Freemason paranoia. Both are inclined to leader worship and to the exclusive stress on the power of one great book. Both have a strong commitment to sexual repression, especially to the repression of any sexual, quote, deviance, end quote, and to its counterparts, the subordination of the female and contempt for the feminine. Both despise art and literature as symptoms of degeneracy and decadence. Both burn books and destroy museums and treasures. He goes on to write, fascism and Nazism also attempted to counterfeit the then success of the socialist movement by using pseudo-socialist and populist appeals. Okay. So enough there, except I'm going to cut him right off the kneecaps and say that there was nothing pseudo-socialist about Nazism. That was just socialism. But you see, Christopher Hitchens started out as a Trotskyist, but he was a Marxist. And I got a little fascinated with this train of thought today, and I found a place where he said, he was essentially still a Marxist. He's deceased now and has been since 2011. But at the time that he wrote this, he said he was still essentially a Marxist, but just much more conservative, whatever that means. So I just kept on my hunt, looking for things to talk about. But I kept coming back to Hitchens, because it wasn't even a week ago that I had had a brief exchange with someone who was recommending Hitchens' book from 2007, God is Not Great. And I said, well, I've read that book. Alan read that book. And I said, we also read his brother Peter Hitchens' book, The Rage Against God. and preferred that. Certainly Alan agreed with Peter Hitchens' his assertion in that book that countries that had been Christian once fared better than countries that had never been Christian. And he was bemoaning the decline of Christianity in Great Britain. There are a few things that I could cover, and I may just mention in passing that the Tories are out, Labour's in, Tories are out. Julian Assange, of course, has pled guilty, but that has secured his freedom. Hamas has a ceasefire proposal, and Israel isn't really keen on it. And basically, the proposal is that they want international assurances that once the truce kicks in, both sides will keep negotiating until they reach a final deal to end the war and free all of the hostages remaining in Gaza. Basically, Hamas wants to make sure that they don't release hostages only for Israel to restart the war. But Israel says no, they need that option. So Benjamin Netanyahu, we all heard him say that he has vowed to destroy Hamas and topple them. And so we'll see where that goes. Another thing that I wouldn't mind covering just very, very briefly is that Archbishop Vigano, an Italian archbishop, was just excommunicated by the Catholic Church. And this may not be interesting to everyone, but in 2020, Alan linked to a couple of articles that included a letter that Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano wrote, kind of an open letter that he wrote to Trump warning about the Great Reset. And Alan thought that it was a really good letter and it made a lot of good points. And I was thinking a couple of years ago that Alan really would have liked Vigano's declaration from March of 2022. It was a declaration on the Russia-Ukraine crisis, March 6. And it began with a quotation from Pope Pius XII. On August 24, 1939, Pope Pius attempted to call the nations of Europe to return to understanding and to resume negotiating rather than begin a war that even at that time, before anyone knew of the horrors it would bring, was nevertheless dreaded as the likely bringer of enormous suffering and much death, also because World War I had ended only 21 years before. In 1918, and no one wished for a similar war. So the quote from Pope Pius XII, "All can be lost with war. Let men return to understanding. Let them resume negotiating." He also, Vigano wrote in this declaration, "The Russian-Ukrainian conflict is a very dangerous trap that has been set against Ukraine, Russia, and the nations of Europe. The United States of America and the European nations should not marginalize Russia, but rather form an alliance with her, not only for the restoration of trade, for the prosperity of all, but in view of the reconstruction of a Christian civilization, which alone can save the world from the globalist techno-health transhumanist monster." He closed his declaration by saying, "I earnestly hope that my appeal for the establishment of an anti-globalist alliance that unites the peoples of the world in opposition against the tyranny of the New World Order will be accepted by those who have at heart the common good, peace between nations, concord among all peoples, freedom for all citizens, and the future of the new generations." Well, I committee convened in June to decide upon Vagano's fate, and I guess I'm not Catholic. I have not followed this too closely, but he had ceased to recognize the Pope. And it was decided, I believe, on the 5th of July, that he be excommunicated for schism or schism, however you like to hear that word said. A little bit of my thinking about the differences between Christopher Hitchens and Peter Hitchens had made me think about utopia, Marxism, all utopias, and the essential nature of humans. And I ended up revisiting the thinking of two ancient Confucian philosophers by the name of Mengzi and Xunzi. And they both were philosophers in the Confucian vein, but they had a fundamental disagreement. Mengzi believed that we are innately good-natured, that we are born good. And Xunzi believed that we are innately not good. And we could talk a lot about this topic, I guess. It's a fundamental one of philosophers. And I know where Alan stood on this idea. Alan did not think that humans were fundamentally good. They were born good. That he did not agree with this. And this is an interesting thing. I don't want to start some crazy debate. But when you think about community in the world of people who are questioning or seeking or who may call themselves awake and those who are not, and you see the choices that are sometimes collectively made that are very detrimental to individuals who wish to go a different way, you can incline towards a pessimistic view of humanity. And yet, when I was with family, I realized that what you're looking at, it's not so much sad as it is surreal, because all of these people have a goodness about them. There's a humor and a love and a delight in having fun or doing pleasant things, etc., etc. And yet, on the deepest level, I'm estranged. This isn't my community. And I guess if I'm pressed to say, my community are people who listen to Alan Watt. And yet, even in that group, there's such divisions and differences, and that is interesting, and also raises the question, what is community? And in the Telegram chat room recently, someone had proposed the idea that if we could just all agree on a basic idea like the Ten Commandments as a code for behaving, that it would be better. But someone else in the group didn't like the religious connotations there, and then the person who had proposed it said, well, tell me what you disagree with, you know, thou shalt not kill or steal or covet another man's wife, you know, I mean, what's your disagreement? But it returns me to, in a fundamental way, to Alan, who just always talked about the individual's journey. It's an individual's journey in this world. And so in a way that is, again, not sad, but certainly true, we're on this journey alone. And from time to time, we bump into someone in a physical place or a virtual place, and we feel community with them. And that's not bad. So besides Alan not subscribing to the Mungsa idea that we're innately good, he would not be a materialist. So Christopher Hitchens has called himself a materialist, a humanist, an anti-theist, and he famously quipped about being an animal and the idea that as an animal he couldn't, there could not be a supernatural element to it, you know. He said, this basically, you know, I'm a materialist, I'm a humanist, I'm an anti-theist, I'm an animal. And for him, this was the highest of the high. Alan never gave himself a label, but sometimes the opposite of materialism is called idealism. And it's interesting to me that one of the chief critics of idealism was Bertrand Russell. And without getting too deeply into this, idealism places consciousness as the place of origin. This is where all phenomena start. And I think this is probably a reductionist view of what Alan would think. But I wanted to share just a little bit of his writing with you. Because ultimately, if you're not looking in the mirror, if you're not examining yourself, you're dependent on other people to point you in the direction, in a direction. And once you look at who's pointing you in a direction, you are liable to be misled. Who do you have with the Hitchens brothers? Christopher, now deceased, left-leaning, anti-Zionist, pro-Iraq war. There's an anomaly for you, one that he was famously criticized by many on the left and by his own brother in a famous vocal public feud. Oxford-trained Peter Hitchens, a conservative, Oxford and maybe University of York, but also a journalist. What do they have in common? They both said that they were Marxist or Marxian in their youth, or Trotskyist. Maybe they both said they were Trotskyist, but I mean, let's not split hairs here. They're international socialists. Peter decides to return to his Christian roots that he never really had. Christopher becomes all the more vocal in his atheist, anti-theist position. And he was an excellent debater, and it was always entertaining to watch him. And people can get quite caught up in the arguments of a good debater, especially one that has a little bit of charisma and celebrity charm. But I noticed that he was famous for something called Hitchens' razor, like Occam's razor. A razor is a rule. And Hitchens' razor is, what can be asserted without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence. And of course, this was mostly used by him to refute religious belief. But I'm going to use Hitchens' razor on Hitchens. He wrote a memoir called Hitchens 2-2. I don't know what year that was, but maybe 2010. And in that, he outed himself for some homosexual relations that he had had. But he not only did that, but he made the claim that all or most men who call themselves heterosexual have either had a homosexual relationship or have had homosexual fantasies or thoughts about a homosexual relationship. And to me, this is just Hitchens' razor. What can be asserted without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence. This is nothing but Kinsey. It's just pure Kinseyism that he's promoting. Yeah. What did Kinsey do with his fraudulent studies on male sexuality? He talks to pedophiles and homosexual men and then says, all men are that. All men have a propensity to that. So I see no difference there. And I'm not going to go point by point. I'm not a good debater, and this isn't the point of bringing it up. The point of bringing it up was, when we look to men, who are we looking at? Both Peter Hitchens and Christopher Hitchens, each in their own way, have promoted war. If it's a just war, if it's a war of defending yourself, etc., etc. But as journalists, you're never from them going to receive the full story. Alan always gave us as complete a picture as he possibly could, the full story. Who is behind something? Who benefits? What really happened in Ukraine? I mean, this is an ongoing, long battlefield, you could say. But certainly, going back to at least 2014, you have very clear U.S. involvement in Ukraine. So, as Hitchens vilifies Putin and his aggression, but that can't be done as a one-sided argument, because the history of that region has had too much Western intervention for too long. And if you listen to tonight's talk by Alan, too much Freemasonic intervention for too long to just make it right now all about Russia. This is what you get with men. And I think the beauty of this talk for me, ultimately, is that it is anti-war. And Alan was very consistently anti-war. So much of his first book, Cutting Through Volume 1, is about Freemasonry and the techniques, the human inventions of religion and the human control of religions, the human hand behind wars. But it is also full of anti-materialist, anti-humanist ideas, and very, very human. In other words, Alan knew that humans can be deceived. They can find themselves warm and comfortable in a community that promotes the non-binary, that supports all things diverse and inclusive, because humans have a deep, deep psychological need to fit in and to be a part of something. And our families are broken. I mean, I could tell you all kinds of observations I had about mine just this last week. But our families are really, for the most part, broken. And we come together only to be reminded of how broken they are. But there is still, in Alan's work, this through line that is nothing short of a celebration of what is beautiful and possible in the human mind. So after spending the whole first volume explaining the ancient priesthood and the cons and Freemasonry, etc., etc., he talks about how does one get out of the flock, whether it's the leader is political or religious. And he said, this work is for the individual spirit, for those who know that this universe and this world was made by something greater and more wonderful than human minds could ever dream of. The simplicity of accepting this is the beginning of personal freedom. It is the beginning of life. To live instead of exist is a miracle in itself. Personal experience must be the guide, for everyone knows what is right or wrong. We are not animals. We have an intellect which makes us far more dangerous than any animal. The Creator gave us the ability to live and care for each other, accepting the world as it was made. The deviants were not satisfied and thought they could improve the design. For every improvement, there is a side effect, which the scientists counter by more science, more side effects. Science and its peculiar cultural elitism has already the means and method to remedy the planet's ills. They have had hundreds of international meetings since the days of Malthus, the economist for the East India Company. Today was planned over 200 years ago. They envisioned a world united, free of useless eaters, where only a minority ruling class would survive, served by a restricted, altered, genetically modified population of slaves. We are spirits descended into matter for a purpose. Understanding this and fulfilling this is the meaning of the term having life and having it more abundantly. This does not mean accumulation of products. It means doing that which is true. Truth is eternal. It cannot alter. Only truth will make you free. Sometimes when I'm amongst family or groups of acquaintances or just out and about, I am a stranger in a strange land. For me, Alan is community. Because the community that I want to live in is free. It does not wage war one on the other. And I don't find that amongst the talking heads, no matter how clever they are, no matter how exciting their arguments may be, no matter how blinding the science is presented, no matter how blinding the science that's presented, I can still see it isn't true. Well, have a good week, and I'll talk to you later.
Hi, I'm Alan Watt at CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com. and .net, and a few others which you'll see on the site. Today is February the 23rd, 2007. To finish off this week, I was thinking to talk about an event which happened in the 20th century, which was almost lost in the massive upheavals going around the world at the time, across Europe especially, and that was the famine in the Ukraine. The Ukrainian people had an incredibly hard time being whacked first by the communist system, the Soviet system, and eventually became a battlefield when the Soviets moved in World War II, while the Nazis were also moving in World War II, and the people who lived primarily in rural areas were being butchered by both sides. Horrible, horrible events occurred there, which have been glossed over, as we tend to do, in this wonderful world of ours, where we deny the nasty stuff and it eventually gets swept under the carpet of time. We are so far removed in the so-called civilized countries from the horrors of war that they're now not even real to most people. People today can't tell the difference between fiction and reality. We've seen so many people blown up in movies, very realistic movies, that we can't tell the difference anymore. It means nothing. And that's why horror can be repeated. It's easier to do it on an unsuspecting, civilized public who go into a complete state of shock when it breaks out. The Ukraine had vast farmlands with small peasant owners who had lived there for generation upon generation, built their own houses, very self-sufficient and independent people, a rich culture. But to the Darwinists and anthropologists that made up the Nazi and Soviet systems, these people were classed really as a stagnant population. They were not progressive. And if you're not progressive, they come down with a big stick on you to teach you a lesson or eliminate you. That's part of the Darwin theory. Those who can't adapt into this new system that's supposed to naturally evolve have to be eliminated and can't go forward into the new, an old Hindu philosophy, really, since that's what Darwinism is based on, and all Freemasonry is too. This article comes from themossnews.com, from, I guess, Moscow, created on the 27th of the 11th, 2006. This is what it says. Ukraine marks the 73rd anniversary of Soviet-era famine that claimed 10 million lives. When people ask me about monuments or social days towards Holocausts, I've said over and over, I wish every country would put up memorials to government-created Holocausts to their own peoples, because they're all over the world. This is what it says. Holding flickering candles and standing in perfect stillness, thousands of Ukrainians gathered on a fog-shrouded square to mourn 10 million compatriots who died of starvation during a man-made Soviet-era famine 73 years ago, the Associated Press reports. During the height of the 1932 to 1933 famine, known here as Holodomor, or death by hunger, 25,000 people died every day, devastating entire villages. Cases of cannibalism were widespread as desperation deepened. Those who resisted were shot or sent off to Siberia. I do not ask, I demand that the Ukrainian parliament recognize Holodomor as genocide, President Viktor Yushchenko told the crowd gathered on Kiev's Mykhailivka Square on Saturday in a short address followed by a minute of silence and the tolling of bells. Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin provoked the famine in a campaign to force peasants to give up their private farms and join collectives. This collective stuff really gets to me, you know. We're all one. We all have to be one. Our new communitarianism, which has been propagated in the West, the same stuff. We're all a big community. And it's not a recent thing, phenomena. This has been going on since the Soviet system, this whole idea towards the collective, the hive. Authorities collectivized agriculture throughout the Soviet Union, but farmers in Ukraine, known as the breadbasket of the USSR, fiercely resisted and bore the brunt of the man-made disaster. Moscow has warned Kiev against using the term genocide, arguing that the issue should not be politicized, and some Ukrainian lawmakers agreed, proposing that it be termed, a tragedy instead. It was a tragedy. Yes. These are legalisms at work again to try and take the nastiness out of of what actually happened. It was just a tragedy. That real people just like you and I and mum and dad and granny and grandpa were starved to death and killed and shot. Russia argues that the orchestrated famine did not specifically target Ukrainians and also affected others, including Russians and Kazakhs, but historians say that the overwhelming majority of victims were Ukrainians, and the famine coincided with Stalin's effort to quash growing Ukrainian nationalism. I hope people realize how Sovietization and the Western capital system are one and the same thing, since their goal is exactly the same. To end nationalism was the cry of the Soviets by creating a world empire of collectivization, specialization, bureaucracies, and no independent planning of your own life. It'd all be planned for you by experts, and that just happened to be the same thing in the West. Yushchenko appealed to Russia to stand by our side and recognize the mass starvation as genocide. With this high example, demonstrate the human empathy that is inherent to the Russian people, he said. How can it be called anything but genocide, said Katerina Krivenko, 78, who recalled crying at the feet of Soviet officials as they ransacked her family's village home, carting off what little food her family had managed to hide under floorboards. Authorities took everything, and Krivenko's father and three brothers and sisters died. During the Soviet era, the mass starvation was a closely guarded state secret, but information trickled out over the years. 10 nations, including the United States, have recognized the famine as an act of genocide, defined as a deliberate and systematic destruction of a racial, political, or cultural group. Genocide is a crime under international law, but don't hold your breath, they won't take this any further. Ukraine's parliament speaker, Alexander Moroz said Saturday that he supports recognizing the mass starvation as genocide and said the President's bill would come before Parliament this week. Some lawmakers from the Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych's Russia-leading party of regions, they're a party of regions, suggested watering it down, but party member Taras Chornovil predicted the President's version would ultimately pass. Yanukovych joined Yushchenko on Saturday's commemorations. Those who deny the Holodomor hate us, our spirit, our future. Yushchenko told the crowd that gathered on the square after a silent procession in which marchers carried aloft white banners representing every Ukrainian region. Black ribbons were hung from the banners. Black ribbons were also hung on Ukraine's blue and yellow national flag Saturday. The tragedy of such a scale that is hard to ever imagine, said Oksana Yatsuk, 18, as she held a flickering candle, one of 25,000 expected to be laid on two Kiev squares to honour the victims. And to think that one man created all this terror, this genocide. Under Stalin, each village was ordered to provide the state with a quota of grain, but the demands typically exceeded crop yields. It's kind of like taxation from government. It always seems to exceed what you can afford. As village after village failed to meet the requirements, they were put on a blacklist. The government seized all food, and residents were prohibited from leaving, effectively condemning them to starvation. On behalf of Ukraine, I will insist that the victims of Holodomor be recognized as martyrs of one of the biggest catastrophe in the history of mankind, Yushchenko said. Perhaps instead of having children recite a national prayer to obey a system over which they have no control, they could recite the following in school and learn it by heart, perhaps.
Once upon a time in the land of Hushabai, around about the wondrous days of yore, I came across a sort of box bound up with chains and locked with locks and labeled, "Kindly do not touch. It's war." Decree was issued round about, all with a flourish and a shout, and a gaily colored mascot tripping lightly on before. "Don't fiddle with this deadly box or break the chains or pick the locks. And please, don't ever play about with war." Well, the children understood. Children happened to be good. They were just as good around the time of yore. They didn't try to pick the locks or break into that deadly box. They never tried to play about with war. Mommies didn't either. Sisters, aunts, grannies neither, because they were quiet and sweet and pretty in those wondrous days of yore. Well, very much the same as now. Not the ones to blame somehow for opening up that deadly box of war. But someone did. Someone battered in the lid and spilled the insides out across the floor. A sort of bouncy, bumpy ball made up of guns and flags and all the tears and horror and the death that goes with war. It bounced right out and went bashing all about and bumping into everything in store. And what was sad and most unfair is that it didn't really seem to care much who it bumped, or why, or what, or for. It bumped children, mainly. And I'll tell you this quite plainly. It bumps them every day, and more, and leaves them dead and burned and dying, thousands of them sick and crying. Because when it bumps, it's really very sore. Now, there's a way to stop the ball. It isn't difficult at all. All it takes is wisdom. I'm absolutely sure that we could get it back into the box and find the chains and lock the locks. No one seems to want to save the children anymore. Well, that's the way it all appears, because it's been bouncing round for years and years, in spite of all the wisdom whiz since those wondrous days of yore. And the time they came across the box, bound up with chains and locked with locks, and labeled, "Kindly do not touch. It's war."
Now, while I'm on the Ukraine, I can tie this in with, from the same moznews.com, Ukrainian parliamentary blurb here, where they suggest jailing Freemasons. This is from the 7th to the 12th, 2004. You see, Freemasonry, under the guise of charity and just a good bunch of guys having a joke with each other, a little club, a little boys' club, is a help themselves organization which takes over any system into which it's introduced, with oaths of secrecy, blood oaths and death oaths and all the rest of it. And you'd have to ask yourself why charitable organizations must take death oaths for charity's sake. Of course, it's nothing to do with charity. The big charity is in their own pockets, and they help each other to get contracts, especially government contracts. They must swear to keep each other's secret from the public and from everyone else, the profane, as they say. It's a system that runs the systems in every country. Once the Soviet Union came down, it was in the newspapers in the West that Freemasons from America and Britain were sending brothers off to re-establish Masonic lodges in these particular Sovietized countries. So they get in right away, and you wonder why the corruption's going on, and how these boys manage to keep all their little deals secret, these multi-million dollar deals they end up getting. Well, the Brotherhood's alive and well, that's why. So this little blurb goes like this. Ukrainian MP Taras Chornovil has suggested that the country's parliament, the Supreme Rada, introduce criminal responsibility for Freemasonry, the MIG News website reported on Tuesday. Taras Chornovil is the son of late nationalist leader Vyacheslav Chornovil and his appointment as an advisor to presidential candidate Viktor Yanukovych on West Ukrainian affairs earlier this year provoked much criticism in nationalist circles. I've got problems with my mic here. He will head Yanukovych's campaign headquarters in the repeat of the controversial second round of Ukrainian presidential elections. He has submitted to the Rada bill entitled "On Amendments to the Criminal Code of Ukraine," according to which membership of Freemason organizations or any other organizations that require ritual and oaths of higher priority than the current law must be punished by a jail sentence up to 3 years. The bill also reads that the members of Masonic organizations who are Ukrainian civil servants, law enforcers, or military servicemen must be jailed for 3 to 7 years. Now, I doubt if they got this bill through. Ukraine's president, members of parliament, civil servants of ministerial rank, military servicemen and law enforcers of the rank of major general or higher, if discovered to be members of Freemason organizations, may face up to 10 years in prison. If the membership in a Masonic organization causes deaths, a threat to Ukraine's national integrity, or its defense potential, members of the organization must be imprisoned for 10 to 15 years, the bill reads. In February, the leader of Ukraine's Socialist Party, Alexander Moroz, said that about 300 of Ukraine's top officials were members of the St. Stanislaus Order Masonic Lodge. Later, other left-wing parties and also the pro-Western bloc headed by Yulia Tymoshenko also called on the government to ban the St. Stanislaus Order in Ukraine. So you see, these characters have their little clubs throughout all the countries, especially up in the realms which you take for granted, your police, your military, civil service, bureaucracy, politicians. It's wherever the public money feeds them, that's where they are. The public produce the honey for the hive. That's your tax money. That's where the biggest money happens to be. It's in that big pot. And they all want to get in there and take the scoops of it out for themselves. So they put their boys in at the top to make sure that the honey trickles in the right direction. And it's run on a criminal basis, basically, where they are an elitist group claiming to be enlightened, and it's their duty, really, to use the profane. That's what the profane are there for, according to them. So other countries are having their problems with them, and they're sworn to secrecy. Well, how can they be sworn to secrecy to serve a brotherhood first and foremost, and help each other, and lie on oath for each other, if need be, and serve your country too? It's impossible, you see. This is through the entire world, this system, from the top to the bottom. And many people live their lives completely oblivious of it. They don't know why they can't get the right jobs. They don't know why they're passed over for promotions and so on. And it's because they don't have the right connections. That's why. Now here is another country that's got its big problems with Freemasonry. This is from the Observer Guardian Company, UK, with a Northern Ireland story, Saturday, July the 27th, 2003, from the Observer. The police of the police service of Northern Ireland is to become the first in the Western world to make officers register their membership of secret societies such as the Masons. A register of interest will become mandatory for all policemen and women, up to and including Chief Constable Hugh Ord, within the next 3 weeks. And the register, which will reveal how many officers hold membership of the Orange Order, will also be handed over to Northern Ireland's police ombudsman, Nuala O'Lone. She will have the right to refer during investigations into alleged bias, maltreatment of suspects, or the mishandling of police inquiries to any officer's membership of secret societies. You will see that Northern Ireland, for instance, where the Orange Order, probably one of the most militant orders within Freemasonry, which gives allegiance to the Queen, the Crown. And I know lots of them over in Scotland and Ireland. I've met them. And these guys are fanatics. They're trained from childhood to be fanatics and to hate Catholics, to utterly hate them. And yet, you know, this is one of the older orders of Freemasonry, which the British government used very effectively in the armed forces as far back as the 1700s. The first travelling lodges, as they call them, were in the British regiments. They swore complete allegiance to the Crown. Regardless of whatever they were told to do, they would do it. And even through the Americas, these guys, wherever these regiments went, they would often leave a lodge behind them in towns, the Orange Order, going back to King Billy, as they call him, King William of Orange. The Orange Free State, the colour of orange is very important in the present world system. And certainly the Orange Free State is too. That's where The Hague happens to be. the Orange Order used to go through the towns in Ireland, I don't know if they still do, and the towns in Scotland as well, with their Orange Day parade. And you would see these characters with their, all their Masonic regalia, and their banners, and guys with swords drawn, and clubs. And they'd do these strange little jeering dances as they went down the road, down the street of their march, supposedly to commemorate the defeating of the Irish a long time ago. And the Catholics were made to watch this and feel as though they were second class or even lower citizens. This was encouraged and held up and authorized by the British Crown, who kept turmoil going. They must keep turmoil going, chaos, to bring out the order. And in Freemasonry, you'll find all the orders of the rainbow with their colors, all specialized in different parts. And remember, not just the primary colors, but the colors in between, even unknown to some of the Masons themselves. Specialized orders. You'll find this in every country on the planet. A religion which encompasses all other religions, and yet is seldom noticed by the people as they walk past these little lodges in their villages, towns and cities, and they think it's just some sort of charitable boys' club where they play themselves and get away from their wives for a little while. It's much, much deeper. You don't take these kind of oaths as an adult and accept the penalties for disclosing the information or the secrets, as they call it. You don't take these kind of oaths lightly. These are taken with complete conviction because they're serious oaths. And they must lie to everyone pretty well to protect a brother. They also let Freemasons off with petty things, fines, parking offences, speeding offences. They get deals on their property assessments when they need loans from banks. They get them very quickly, generally the same day. They're automatically approved and passed and verified and vouched for. A system within a system. And the Masonic policemen, they will stop you and give you the hard time if you give them the right signs and passwords, will let you go. And the guy behind you who doesn't know the right signs and passwords will have to pay up and pay up and pay up and take the consequences. And we call this a fair, just system. There's nothing fair and just about it. And even if you try to close them down, they'll simply metamorph into another thing, another area, a different name, and carry on with more secrecy, because the world is run by secrecy. Your secret services, intelligence services, are Freemasonic as well. It's pretty well mandatory that you must be a Mason to be part of it, because you've already learned how to keep your mouth shut and how to stand up and lie for each other when need be. That's quite the insurance policy for Secret Service agents and people who could take the heat if they were found doing the nefarious things which they often do. It's an insurance policy. Same in the police. That when the police foul up and someone's head is on the block, as they say, because he shot somebody by mistake or whatever, the rest of them will stand up for this guy. They'll all sit and write the same story in their books, stand up in court, and justify whatever ridiculous story they give to get their brother off the hook. There's nothing new in this at all. This kind of behavior encourages worse behavior each time they get away with it, because that's human nature. Not only the male lodges have to be watched carefully and scrutinized, so do the female ones, because the female ones tend to go off onto the school boards and other charity events, and they become directors and so on, and you wonder where all your policies locally are coming from and how we're becoming globalized and following international standards. You got to check out every single person who you have allowed to get up over your head and make laws which affect you. You must demand to know what organizations they have sworn allegiance to. And some of them are very well camouflaged if you just read their names. Tremendously well camouflaged. Not by chance. And people say, how do you stop this? How do you divert it? How do you deflect this agenda? And I tell them, if you are going to play the game, and that's all it is, playing a game of voting in pre-selected people, you better demand to know everything about that person that you're going to give your authority to, who's going to pass laws which will affect you or your children. You have the right to know everything which they have subscribed to, joined, sworn allegiance to, and then you better do your homework and find out what kind of strange religion is this that runs your world, which you think is just a charitable institution. The US is probably the most openly Freemasonic nation or even empire in the world. It's throughout all of its symbols, emblems, parades. You'll see presidents giving speeches. Look at the flags behind them. Look at the objects placed around them. Everything is Freemasonic, openly. You're seeing Freemasonic parades when you watch the military. You look at all the clubs, your business organizations, the banking organizations, the medical. Look at the symbols they use for the medical associations, the Chamber of Commerce and so on. And even the trade unions, which used to do marches through the streets with their banners, look at them very carefully, because all of it and all of it is Freemasonic. It's quite incredible that populations can come and go, generations can come and go, and have no idea, even though it's all around them, that they're being guided and run and ruled by a religion. A religion that shows its symbols openly, and you become used to them, taking it for granted it must be somehow normal to have the same symbols repeated as logos, etc., all around you. There's the one big religion which runs all the religions. And yes, you have ministers who are members. Some of the church organizations are worse than others. I think the Baptist Church in the States openly admitted they have the most Freemasonic members who are ministers, and that was okay with them. But the other ones are the same too. In fact, in some of the Masonic books, they take credit and tell you the names of the founders of the different sects of religions, Protestant sects, in the United States, and they tell you what degree of Freemasonry they happen to be. And the flocks, the sheep, never know, never think to ask, what is all of this, these strange symbols? Or why would their minister be a member of a club that keeps its secrets to itself? Remember that when the Templars moved off from France with their fleet, which was never found, they didn't stop there. They went across to Scotland, made their base on the west coast of Argyllshire, and metamorphed into another society, which was allowed. Some of the members were allowed to marry and mix with the people. And who ran the banking system of the time? Well, the Templars did. They never stopped. Chameleons can come into any church and take over. With the money backing them, they could start all the big branches of banking, business, the medical system. And knowing they'd have opposition as they plundered the public, they created the trade unions and managed that side as well. But of course, most people would prefer to believe, because generally they have members who belong to it, low-level members, that it's just a charitable organization. Even though their flag, when the Templars used their sea flag, you had the skull and bones of the pirates who plundered and sunk ships after they robbed them, with all hands on board and all passengers too. Plundering, plundering, and plundering. And what was Albert Pike said in Morals and Dogma? To gain power by all means and every means, including the stock market manipulation, that's what he meant, and become the masters over the masters of the world. And those who understand the rest of his book will understand the agenda that he was talking about and where they would take society through science and so on. Worlds within worlds, wheels within wheels. All around you, and most of the people are oblivious, or think they know what it is because Uncle Joe's a member, and he comes home drunk once in a while from the club. That's a very good cover. How can you have a society which declares on the one hand that it's open and demands your allegiance and your pay packet at times, and on the other hand the same politicians, bureaucrats with their own little secret signs and handshakes and stances and quips and words and their winks to each other can plunder you? You can't have both and expect any kind of just system. Well, this is from Manly P. Hall. Manly P. Hall was a spokesperson for Freemasonry, put out to mystify the young through the writings, cause intrigue, promote mysteries, hint at solutions to attract the youth into these organizations. He was a 33rd degree Freemason and probably much higher. But this is what he said about the craft of Masonry. All true Masons know that their work is not secret, but they realize that it must remain unknown to all who do not live the true Masonic life. Yet if the so-called secrets of Freemasonry were shouted from the housetops, the fraternity would be absolutely safe. For certain spiritual qualities are necessary before the real Masonic secrets can be understood by the brethren themselves. Hence it is that the alleged exposures of Freemasonry, printed by the thousands and tens of thousands in 1730 down to the present hour, cannot injure the fraternity. They reveal merely the outward forms and ceremonies of Freemasonry. Only those who have been weighed in the balance and found to be true, upright and square, have prepared themselves by their own growth to appreciate the inner meanings of their craft. To the rest of their brethren, within or without the lodge, their sacred rituals must remain, as Shakespeare might have said, words, words, words. So he is telling you right there that even the lower Masons don't know what it's all about either. They think they do. As Mr. Pike said, they believe that they think they know what all the symbolism and ritualism means, but it's not necessary that they actually really do comprehend what it means. They're taking oaths to things which they don't understand, and an agenda which they don't understand, in the hope, really, not to improve themselves personally, but improve themselves financially and status-wise within communities. He uses the term sacred here, sacred rituals, because Freemasonry is a religion. You can tell by its history of revolutions and so on that it's a very powerful religion. It's led revolutions. It has a goal. Hall himself talks about Masons taking the oaths without comprehending the import of them. They're deadly serious. He also talks about evolution through the ages. He says a Mason cannot be ordained or elected by ballot. He is evolved through ages of self-purification and spiritual transmutation. Here is part of the belief structure. Through ages of purification, reincarnation, and spiritual transmutation, the alteration of spirit itself. He also talks about hidden masters, the same as Theosophy, which is just an ordained branch of Freemasonry. There are many, many openly Freemasonic organizations using different names, and there are also a vast amount of other ones, probably more, with innocuous sounding names, all working towards the same agenda, and they're encouraged to go on to all kinds of societal boards, like school boards, councils, that kind of thing, anything to do with social change and guidance, and definitely in education, big time. And they're also encouraged to accept brethren from all other faiths, which is fine, except that out of all that comes a more elitist group who believe that they've transcended all of that to join a high group, a group beyond religions, that the supreme religion, you might say. They would say it's a supreme religion. And they take it all on faith. They take it on faith from the top to the bottom. that those above them who have more secrets and who give them orders know what they're doing. So it's a faith-based religion. To obey orders instantly without allowing your own personal opinion or emotion to become involved. That's quite the religion. Faith-based. The perfection of man to perfect that which was left imperfect is their goal, supposedly. And sure enough, like all self-help groups, you think, well, I guess it's just a correspondence course from the Californian-based Rosicrucians, where you're told how to better yourself and how to watch your words and watch your thoughts and emotions and so on. But it's much, much bigger than all of that. Because as you go up the reading process, understanding process, you realize there's an incredible elitism involved at the top, which believes in eugenics. They believe in superior types of humanity, and they also believe that we have evolved as far as we can go in this present state. Therefore, all of those at the top of the tree, the Darwinian tree, you might say, deserve to be there, the creme de la creme, in all peoples. And they themselves constitute a new race altogether. That's what they believe. They don't think that anything else can come up from the vast pool of the profane down below. The gene war is over as far as they're concerned at the top. And it's tremendously interesting, underneath all of the allegories, which is really allegory piled upon allegory, they talk about perfecting man with the little occasional hints at what they mean by perfection. Everyone's been taught in the West, that is, since it was decided to give a particular version of religion to the Western busy bees, that at first a deity created the perfect likeness of himself into Adam. And if you read the original wording, it does mean the perfect sameness, absolute sameness. And the hint is that the fall of Adam was loneliness. Therefore, that which was also in Adam, which was female, was removed and made separate, which also meant that the deity itself was both male and female. How would you perfect that which was left imperfect unless you put the male and female back together? And who are these hidden masters they talk about that guide the higher worthy brethren? The same ones that Theosophy talks about. Why would a society which uses the garb of helping society through charity, etc., and makes a big thing of their charitable contributions to society, why would it have to take blood-curling oaths for charity? If that's all they were about, of course they wouldn't need to. It's just that if society ever realized the ultimate intention of this worldwide religion, which was is within every religion. They guide every religion. If they knew the ultimate intent, if they knew the ultimate doctrine, they might not see it in the same way at all as a bunch of good old boys getting together and wearing fancy clothes and prancing round an altar. And why can they themselves, in all positions of authority, forgive fellow Masons on certain things and yet slap the profane with penalties? Where is the equality in that? Isn't that a tremendous class distinction? We're looking at elitist organizations. Their training manuals are big into selecting the right mate or having them selected for you, and the correct rearing of the young who will then themselves enter the craft. You're looking at eugenics. You're looking at the judgment upon the commoners who don't have their mates picked for them. And you're looking at the basis of a system which cannot help because of secrecy and obligations to each other but be corrupt. A Mason must lie to defend a fellow Mason on oath. And you can find these lodges around the planet, in small towns and villages, and in within cities. You'll see the architecture in parliament buildings of this religion. Their architecture is everywhere. Their logos, their symbols are everywhere. They use a language of symbolism to evoke in those who understand a very understandable language. The universal religion. And Masons are allowed and encouraged to enter into active participation in the religions of their choice or those in which they were born and brought up, knowing at all times that's all part of the great work to guide society on a faith-based mission, believing that superiors know what they're doing and that it must be for good reason. You can have no justice in a system where courts, lawyers, judges, and all the regalia of the courtroom is nothing more than a Freemasonic temple. There can be no possible justice there. What is justice? Is justice simply a battle between lawyers using their own terminology and wit to outdo the other? Or does it have to do with right and wrong? And it's nothing to do with right and wrong. Freemasonry, in its present form in the West, came through different organizations, including Knights Templars, the Hospitallers, came through different sects of monks. And what they all have in common are uniforms. Uniform, one form, one shape. Part of their religion is the oneness of everything. However, the oneness of everything does not include necessarily the capstone. That's for the elect. So for the masses, it may be oneness for you. Kind of like one size fits all. I'd like to go into a talk to do with perceptions. On my next verb. To show you how sciences and conditioning have allowed us to live in a science fiction reality, a greater science fiction reality than any novel has ever written, and show you the absurdity and criminality and the genius behind controlling our minds for such a long time, so that we see things in a completely different way from that in which they are. Through massive conditioning indoctrination from birth. That's all for me tonight. So from Hamish and me, it's a nice, good, snowy night, and may your God or gods go with you.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September when grass was green and the grain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you
follow.
Oh.